Welcome to the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Macramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. This week, we're joined by one of our favorite writers and guests, whose work you can find on Baseball Prospectus. It's Rachel McDaniel. Rachel, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
So on this week's episode, we'll discuss the renaming of AT&T Park, Trevor Bauer's Twitter harassment, the past week's signing and trades, Kyler Murray likely choosing the NFL over MLB, the brilliance of bat flips, and Rachel will answer some questions about their approach to baseball writing. Then, as usual, we'll conclude with this week in baseball history. So let's dive right into things with the news that AT&T Park is now Oracle Park. Sadly, since the stadium is no longer named for a telecommunications phone company, it doesn't seem at all fitting to refer it as the phone booth anymore. What fun nicknames can we give it instead?
The mouthpiece of the gods?
Yeah, I like that.
That's the only thing I can think of.
I was going to say Delphi. But like, I am very excited about this because I do a lot of work on oracles in my schooling. So it's I think it's going to be a good one for me. Although I did love the phone booth, but it's always good to have new opportunities for weird references that maybe two people will get.
Yeah, pun-wise, Oracle Park really opens up a whole new world of opportunities that AT&T just cannot offer.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many narratives that we can just kind of weave into every single season with the Giants that I think will be really, really fun to explore.
I just keep thinking about The Matrix, like the movie, and how there's a character named the Oracle in it. And now I'm just going to keep making Keanu Reeves jokes because that's how I naturally am.
I don't remember that character from The Matrix, but
I think it was in Matrix Reloaded and Revolution.
I've seen all of them, but I don't remember. I think I just blocked them out because I didn't like them. So I was just like, okay, I watched this. Now I'm done with it and I'll never think of it again.
Yeah, the sequels were bad. But I know some people would also call AT&T Park Maze Field because Willie Mays, which is also a non-corporate name to call it, which is nice. But yeah. I am looking forward to all the Oracle puns.
Yeah, maybe something like the crystal ball could work.
Yeah.
I like that we all went that route instead of like actually focusing on what Oracle does, because like who actually knows what Oracle does?
Yeah. I have no idea what Oracle is.
I like read the article on it and I still don't know.
Yeah.
I thought you could say more about me.
It's like the word.
I just know that they have the arena across the bay in Oakland and that they're headquartered in the East Bay, and I still don't exactly know what they do, and I lived in the Bay Area for 5 years.
I mean, I guess that's fitting because they're Oracle. They're a mystery. Who knows what their purposes or their sources are?
Yeah, I think that could be a very neat thing for the Giants, because like, who knows what the Giants will be this season? Who knows the lessons that we're supposed to learn from the team?
So you have to go to the Oracle to find out.
Yeah, and then the Oracle will tell you absolute nonsense and you'll be like, yes. Precisely.
Which is exactly fitting because the Giants are complete nonsense lately.
Yeah, you can kind of cull whatever you want from them in order to craft your narrative. Well, moving on, Trevor Bauer, I think as everybody has seen, is up to his usual nonsense once more. Earlier in the week, a college-aged woman quote-tweeted Bauer to say he was one of her least favorite ballplayers. We can all relate to that. Bauer proceeded to spend the next 14 hours tagging her in tweets, totaling over 80 tags per her account. She eventually had to lock her account due to the amount of harassing replies she was receiving from his 135,000 followers, but that alone wasn't enough, as her phone number made the rounds as well. Bauer, of course, issued something of a non-apology, saying he would be more responsible with his platform in the future, but never really owning up to what he actually did wrong. He also left a media scrum when a reporter brought the subject up, ending it after roughly a minute. Is there any chance whatsoever Bauer will ever be made to face any kind of real consequences for his actions?
Extremely doubtful. Like, extremely, extremely doubtful. Not only given the environment of Major League Baseball, but also given what typically happens on Twitter with people who have many, many followers and are prominent, who engage in harassment. Like, nothing is going to stop or change, I think, is my pessimistic view on it.
Yeah, I think that at this point, I don't know. I just have very little faith in baseball and Cleveland to actually do anything about it. So
I think the only chance that something, I guess, positive or marginally positive can come of it is if, like, I was honestly surprised that Bauer made any sort of attempt at apologizing at all. So I don't know if the public shaming maybe this time was significant enough that he would not go there again for fear of retribution from the public. I think and at least nobody else will ever have to go through this again. Like, nobody else will get his followers sicked on them, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I hope that's the case, but I also have no idea if, like, someone in the Cleveland front office was like, you need to apologize, and he was only forced to do it, and who could enable him to do something else in the future, or if it's like a coded attack on someone. I just don't trust Bauer to, like, do the right thing.
Yeah, me neither. Especially with the way that he went about the whole interview thing. He got very pissy about it, even though before he was like, oh, blah, 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 reporters never ask me things, yada, 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 et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't really seem promising, particularly since, again, yesterday he called out all of the burner accounts that are tweeting at him. So he just seems to use Twitter as a vehicle to spread, you know, hate. So I don't see him ceasing doing that. It would be really great if he at least learned from this that there is some sort of, no matter how small it is, consequence for constantly harassing a woman on Twitter. But I don't know, because it didn't really seem like Major League Baseball or the Indians remotely cared about his actions on Twitter. With the Indians essentially saying that players run their own Twitter and they don't really care what they post. So that does not fill me with confidence, but I would like to be surprised.
Yeah, I just feel so pessimistic about the whole situation, knowing how many things, especially like attacks on random people on the internet, like just get away without any consequences. I just feel like, how is this any different? And I think that's a sad thing, because this could be a place that Cleveland and MLB could use as a learning opportunity, but I doubt we're going to see that.
Yeah, it just comes as really short-sighted from them, given the number of issues that players have had on Twitter this season, being kind of brought up from several years ago. So now here's a situation that's happening in the present, and they still don't do anything about it.
Well, moving from hot takes to the hot stove, although we're still waiting on the big two free agents, this is one of the busier weeks so far this offseason. We'll start with Ryan Dozier signing with the Nats for 1 year and $9 million. Since 2014, he's averaged almost 4 wins a season. And last season he did not, but he was both injured and he moved to a different league. So some extenuating circumstances there. Do we think that he will bounce back, and are the Nats poised to make out like bandits on this deal?
Yes and yes.
Yeah, I think Dozier is about as good a bounce back candidate as you could probably find in the free agent market this year. And like, when he has been consistently good for such a length of time, and last year was so anomalously bad that, yeah, I think the Nats will like this deal in the end.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. It's not like Dozier is 35 or 36 years old, and it's you know, at the point where you have players who are expected to sharply decline. So it really does seem like last year was a bit of an anomaly. And I certainly hope that he'll have a bounce back season.
And yeah. In more hot stove news, Jed Lowry signed with the Mets for 2 years and $20 million, giving them a real assortment of infielders now. And since Lowry had surgeries to repair his deviated septum and to remove a cyst from his foot over the 2016 offseason, following the worst season of his career, he has averaged 4.3 WAR per season. And last season, he was worth 4.9 WAR. So does this contract seem like a low ball?
I just want to say the reason why I sound the way I do right now is I just got my deviated septum fixed. So if hoping this means I'm also going to be worth 4+ WAR from now on.
Obviously.
You already are.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
You're going to be MVP level now.
You guys are so supportive. I really appreciate it. this definitely seems like he's a guy who probably is underappreciated and probably could have gotten more in a different market. Just happened to be a free agent at a time when it's really not conducive to getting paid.
Yeah, I wonder if BVW, who used to be Lowry's agent, so that's kind of another layer of mystery and intrigue here, has some sort of like middle infielder bingo card that he's trying to fill out. Because it certainly seems that way. Yeah. Because it's just like looking at their roster, it's a little puzzling just what players they're going to end up starting the season with.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun at the beginning of the season to see where all of these players they've acquired end up playing on the field.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So I've loved watching Jed Lowry when he was with the Red Sox and the A's, not so much the Astros because I am still angry at the Astros for the 2017 postseason. Anyway, I just feel like he is definitely underappreciated, and he is obviously a very productive player and worth pretty good number of wins. He deserves so much more than $20 million at the very least. So it's kind of upsetting that that's how much he's making. But also glad that he's playing somewhere and he's getting that much. Because like 10 years ago, I wasn't sure if he would ever move out of the utility infielder role. It's a land of contrasts and I just want him to get paid.
I would also like to throw out the idea that he deserves better than the Mets as well.
Yes. However, shout out to one of my very, very close friends, Steph, who's a Mets fan and a big Jed Lowry fan. So this is her dream come true, and I am only happy about it for that reason alone. So yes, Manny Grandal signed with the Brewers, and it was one of the more shocking deals of the offseason so far, as the contract is just for 1 year and $18.25 million. How did the guy who was touted as the best free agent catcher on the market only manage 1 year and slightly just above the qualifying offer amount?
Well, I think the obvious answer is collusion. That is how he got just a one-year contract, because I can't see every single team looking at the postseason and just abstracting from that the fact that he's not worth so much more than what he received.
Yeah, like there's the list of teams in baseball that would not have their production from the catcher position significantly bettered by acquiring Grandal is like very, very few. And so it seems completely nonsensical that the Brewers would be able to offer like this, that this was the best offer that he could have taken. Like, I know the Mets offered him a bigger contract that he turned down, but the fact that it's just these two teams that we've heard about, even like, why isn't every single team not after him if you can get him for 1 year and $18 million, like qualifying offer level? It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree. It's just ridiculous, especially if it's just like right above the qualifying offer amount, as Rachel said. And also, as Mary said, it's collusion. It's very clear that there is something going on here. And I know today, which is Saturday, I think it was Saturday that this was posted, either today or yesterday. Anyway, Jake Arrieta posted something on Twitter saying, like, if you're getting deals with, like, this many years, like, less than three, like, you better be paying attention to what's going on in MLB. And he has a point there. There's something going on.
Mm-hmm. At the point where we're like, yeah, Jake Arrieta nailed it. And he did.
Yeah, he absolutely did. And I think it speaks a lot to what's happening in Major League Baseball that the Brewers are seen as one of the very few teams who is trying to get better, and they still only offered him a one-year contract.
Which is preposterous because Yasmani Grandal is totally worth more than 1 year and worth more than $18+ million.
Well, the Dodgers may not have re-signed Grandal, but they welcomed another old friend back by trading two prospects for Russell Martin, who last played for LA in 2010. Does the acquisition of Martin mean the Dodgers are set at catcher?
I mean, I think you could never assume that the Dodgers are done because it's the Dodgers. But at the same time, you do kind of wonder what options were made for them at this point because, you know, the obvious guys out there were Grandal and Real Muto. And now Grandal's off the table, and it doesn't seem like the Marlins are going to be budging on Real Muto's terms anytime soon. So in terms of what they could do instead, I guess they're running low on options, besides like just hoping Will Smith is ready sooner than they expect. Because, I don't know, relying on a tandem of Russell Martin and Austin Barnes, that just seems like a dangerous game. Martin hasn't had an above-average offensive season since 2015. Barnes was really good in 2017, but significantly regressed last year. And in reality, he's probably somewhere between a 138 OPS plus and a 72 OPS plus. But, you know, you don't know exactly what you're going to get, especially with a guy who, you know, has never been the main catcher for an entire season. So are they done? I don't know. They probably shouldn't be, but at this point, I'm not sure exactly what there is left for them to do.
Yeah, I would agree that they shouldn't be, but they're kind of running out of options unless they're going to go for Real Muto or the terms change in some way. I guess like acquiring Martin because the Jays wanted to move him and they were willing to eat so much of his salary, I guess was kind of like a risk. Like a low risk deal for the Dodgers. And Martin is like an extremely smart person and a very good defensive catcher and apparently a good clubhouse presence. So,
yeah, it seems like they're more kind of bringing Russell Martin back to kind of have somewhat of a mentor presence in the clubhouse.
Veteran presence, essentially.
Yeah, thank you. And it seems like they've got a couple of catchers in the system that they might try and bring up throughout the season and kind of have Russell Martin work with them. But as for, you know, the catcher position that they're going to go with throughout the season and whether it's going to be productive for them, it seems like the tandem of Russell Martin and Austin Barnes could be vastly improved.
Yeah, I feel like they are by no means set. I don't think they're really going to be truly set until they finalize their 25-man opening day roster. There's definitely room for improvement. I think the Dodgers are still going to be looking at other options that may be possible. But it's also certainly possible that it's going to be a Martin and Barnes platoon behind the plate. But I am also just very much looking forward to seeing Russell Martin back in the Dodgers uniform at Oracle Park because there's a lot of history in that rivalry.
And in Oracles.
Exactly.
All right. The other sort of big thing that happened was that Mookie Betts and the Red Sox avoided arbitration with a one-year, $20 million deal making his $9.5 million jump in salary the highest of any arbitration player in history. Is this contract actually significant in any way?
I think it's significant in the fact that you have an MVP player who is only making $20 million, and you have an MVP player who has not received a long-term offer from his club. And I think that that is something that will continue, where all of these young players who are still in arbitration years will continue to go to arbitration each year and will only receive contracts after the team has kind of gone through all of the arbitration and made the players of such an age where they can then quote unquote justify offering them less in a long-term contract.
Yeah, I think it is significant because he is at least making a little bit closer to what he deserves, but Mookie Betts deserves so much more because he is essentially becoming the face of the Red Sox franchise in this day and age, and he is such a high caliber player that he is, you know, MVP and helped the team to a World Series, and is also a competitive bowler who has, you know, been in the World Series of bowling and the World Series in a calendar year. He just deserves so much more. And I don't know if it's something that can be telling that they might avoid any type of arbitration in the future and the Red Sox will just give him the millions that he deserves. But as we mentioned about Grandal and collusion, there's no actually telling what's going to happen.
And a final news item about people choosing to sign somewhere and choosing not to sign somewhere. Kyler Murray, the Oklahoma Sooners quarterback and left fielder, declared that he will enter the NFL draft. So it's likely he'll be a first round pick and will thus forego baseball for the NFL. Many in the baseball community and many Oakland A's fans assumed that he would choose baseball because of the NFL's concussion problems and because of Major League Baseball's guaranteed contracts. So does Murray choosing football over baseball signify larger issues for Major League Baseball?
Yes. I think it just shows much more how the declining interest in baseball is and how and baseball as a whole is also getting less diverse, less you're seeing less two-sport athletes in MLB. And while they weren't necessarily the norm before, it was a lot more common to see how, like, many ball players might have also played basketball or football in their younger days. So it's just kind of showing where baseball is at these days and seeing how NFL does have the concussion problem and MLB has the guaranteed contracts, that he, you know, he's a Heisman winner and obviously he is a high caliber football player, but that he is willing to forego that guaranteed contract and already being a first round draft pick in MLB for the NFL is very telling of MLB as a whole as it tries to reach out to its fan base.
I agree. His whatever signing bonus he'll get in the NFL will be larger than the one that he got from the A's. And you also have to look at minor league conditions and understand why he would prefer to just jump right onto an NFL team and contribute immediately as opposed to having to go through the minor leagues and being paid pennies for so much labor. And then I guess you also kind of have to look at the A's suggested plan for him or one that was leaked and see that what they had planned for him if he does choose baseball over football is going to be something that I think will be really damaging for him. They're planning on rushing him and having him potentially be on the major league roster in 2020, even though he has played significantly fewer baseball games in college and in recent years than you would like to have seen him played in order to make this sort of jump, in order to be able to contribute at the major league level and to not have so much pressure on him, and to not be so unready that his career ends prematurely in Major League Baseball.
Yeah, to me, the most significant aspect of this is the way that minor league baseball and the criminally low pay and the poor playing conditions disincentivize young players from choosing baseball when they could choose to play another sport, even another sport that has such highly publicized issues as the NFL does. So I think that this should probably be a good moment for Major League Baseball to take a look at the system and say something needs to change. But it's not, probably.
Yeah, you have so many kids kind of avoiding football when they're growing up and having their parents essentially ban them from playing football because it is so dangerous with so many long-term concussion issues that these players are getting. And yet you also have the situation where they don't want to go into baseball either because it is such a difficult lifestyle for so many years. And so you have this kind of conundrum that Major League Baseball could very easily put to rest and very easily pick up a lot of children who are turning away from football. But I don't know if that's going to be the case. I don't know if they're going to want to make these sort of concessions.
And yeah, it's just, I feel like it's a big discussion to be had that has so many layers behind it that still need to be talked about, and I would hope that MLB talks about it, but I have a very, very little faith in MLB to actually do things. So, on a brighter note, on Tuesday, Williams Astudillo created a new entry in the bat flip canon while snapping a 1-1 tie in the bottom of the eighth in Game 5 of the Venezuelan Winter League playoff series. Then 2 days later, Fernando Tatis Jr. hit a walk-off home run for Estrellas Orientales of the Dominican League, punctuating it with perhaps an even more magnificent bat flip. What about each of these bat flips were particularly noteworthy?
Well, Astudillo went full Beltre, down on one knee, admiring his moonshot. And the thing about both of these is that the crowd environment was so fantastic. Like, everybody was going absolutely insane when this happened. And for Tatis Jr., it was just the sheer heft of the bat flip was something to behold. They were just great bat flips, and it's awesome.
Yeah, I fully agree with that. And I would like to point out that in no clip I saw of the Tatis bat flip, did you ever see the bat land? Which I think is just incredible. Obviously, I'm pretty sure it had to have landed somewhere, although you never really know. But considering the nature of gravity, it must have come down at some point. But the fact that we have no idea where it went, and so it just seemed like it leapt into the sky for miles and miles, is just an added little bonus.
There was just so many incredible things about it, namely those two things you two have already mentioned. And it's just, I think the fact that they were able to do it in stadiums that really appreciated the bat flip made it even better. And I think it was just, it was a great sight to watch, and I hope it happens in America even more.
Yeah, watching those, 2 minutes of video is by far the most fun I've had interacting with baseball since I saw the Red Sox win the World Series.
Okay, to be fair, that's not a long amount of time, Mary.
Well, listen, Jen, it's at least it's some amount of time, okay?
Long off season. But yeah, these are both, they're very different kinds of players. Like, I feel like what people enjoy about watching them are very different. I feel like that was what was embodied in each of their bat flips. Like with Tatis Jr., he's like one of the top prospects of the game. He's like going to be the savior of the Padres franchise, and like seeing what he can do. And you know, seeing him do it in this dramatic fashion is a hugely exciting thing. And with Estudio, he's just, he's very over the top, I guess. And that's fun to watch. You know, we need more players who aren't afraid of being like super expressive and of, you know, just pimping the ever loving crap out of a home run, because it is so much fun to watch. Like, anybody who doesn't feel that way is someone who is probably not very much fun to be around.
So which MLB player do we think secretly has practiced an incredible bat flip?
Puig for sure practices bat flipping. I feel like that's just a certainty.
Yeah, I agree with that. I also have this image of Mike Trout practicing bat flips just so that he knows that he is better than everybody at hitting in all aspects of that field. But of course, I don't think he would ever pull one out in a game. But I know that he's secretly got a very magnificent one.
Last day of his career, he hits a home run in the bottom of the ninth, like a walk-off home run, and then just flips his bat like to infinity. Like, that would be amazing. I hope Mike Trout does that.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would also like to see him cartwheel around the bases, you know, just to finish it off and do something that nobody has ever done on a bat flip before.
And then he ends the bat flip with a meteorology report. Because why not? A meteorology report about... And then he just starts rambling about space and where his bat might have landed.
I feel like we should not have athletes talk about things in space and, like, things reaching space anymore.
Fair. I personally think I really think Bryce Harper has practiced bat flips a lot, and like, he's keeping it tame for everyone because everyone already gets on his case about bat flips, but we know he's preparing for an incredible one depending on like what moment it is, and he's gonna be ready.
I'm gonna say Chris Sale, because he's the guy who, you know, we haven't gotten to see him bat a ton, but I'll bet if he ever got the chance and he ever actually did something worth bat flipping over, he would absolutely kill it.
I mean, I think that would be undoubtedly the most terrifying bat flip to ever exist.
I was going to say, I don't think kill it is the right phrase with Chris Sale.
Fair. But I would love to see that, because he's just such a peculiar individual in terms of personality, and also the fact that he is a complete string bean on the mound and yet can throw the ball so fast. So it would be interesting to see what he could do with a bat.
I would be mortified and I would love to see it, but I would also like to be like a bazillion miles away from Fenway Park.
Yeah, like
any like, NL park where he would do that at, because I do not want to be anywhere near that.
Maybe he can like pull it out for a World Series game. That would be great.
Have him pinch hit in World Series game, bat flip, make sure that no one's in the stadium for the bat flip.
I mean, legit. Look, it almost happened. He almost got into the game. He was ready to go. He had on his cleats. He was doing exercises and was very disappointed that he did not actually get to go and play the field.
No, pitchers, they're such interesting individuals.
Particularly that one and all the other ones.
As I said about pitchers.
Leave me alone. This is bullying. Speaking of bullying, we're now going to put Rachel on the hot seat with some questions.
Yay!
So starting off, has writing about baseball changed in any way your perspective on the game or how you imbibe baseball?
Yeah, it definitely, it's changed the way that I view baseball and my baseball viewing habits, and also the way I think about the game a lot, because prior to writing for national outlets, I pretty much focused on the Blue Jays. So the game I would watch, like I would watch almost every single Blue Jays game, and then the occasional Dodgers game or Mariners game, but not really seeing much outside of that. Now I try to get a good, I have to try to get a good spread of baseball game watching experiences in. I can't just focus on the one team that I'm a fan of. And And so I spent a lot more time learning about the histories of other teams and learning about other teams' players and whether they're good or not and whether they're bad and what they're poised to do in the future and what they've done in the recent past. And so that has been like a whole new knowledge base for me. And also just as a writer, you have to come up with interesting questions to answer about the game, like interesting vital questions. And so that requires a perspective of thinking critically that you won't necessarily have just being a fan or being somebody who's writing as a fan, just focusing on one team. So that, like, fostering that kind of thought has also been something that's changed for me since I started writing.
Has it in any way lessened your ability to be a full-on fan of the Blue Jays?
Yeah, it does. I think, like, this is what all writers say, but I'm still a fan of the Blue Jays, but it just doesn't feel the same when you have to divide your energy between watching all these different teams and focusing on them compared to back when I could just like focus all my emotional energy in on the Blue Jays and all the baseball I thought about was the Blue Jays. Like, it's just different. There's not as much room in my baseball brain for the Blue Jays anymore, which is like it's not a bad thing necessarily. It just is what it is.
Yeah, it seems like you really kind of need to become more of a quote unquote fan of baseball as a whole, of the inner workings of the game, as opposed to just one singular team when you start to write about it.
Yeah, like it's easier to maintain that kind of single-minded devotion if you're somebody who's writing like from a team fan perspective, but that's not what I do. So that's I've had to kind of change my lens on the game.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's something that a lot of us who've maybe gone from one particular team or like covering a particular team to maybe more expansive coverage have sort of had to reckon with. Is there one piece of advice that you wish you'd had before starting to professionally write on baseball?
I think the most jarring thing for me and the thing that I've had the most difficulty with in the adjustment period from being somebody who's a big fan of baseball to being somebody who's writing about baseball as my job has been that when I was just a fan, watching baseball and thinking about baseball and reading about baseball, and even in the early days writing about baseball, that was what I did to unwind. That was like my relaxation activity. That was where I could like kind of be at peace and forget about the stresses of the world. But when it becomes your job to think about baseball, like baseball becomes one of the stresses of the world that you have to be worried about. And so I think in the early days, I didn't do a very good job of keeping the line between my leisure time and my work time solid. And it ended up with me feeling like very burned out and very stressed out because I was watching baseball as though I was watching it to unwind as I'd done before, except I had my work brain on. So it would end up being that my work brain is on all day, every day, which is not healthy. And that I think is something that's difficult to negotiate if you're not expecting it. Because you're just thinking, like, I love baseball. Wouldn't it be great to think about baseball all the time and have that be my job? And it is great. You just have to be careful.
Is there something that's kind of snuck into your life to replace the leisure that you previously found in watching baseball?
That's a good question. I mean, I always have done knitting to relax. So that's kind of a... I've also been going to massage therapy, so I guess that's my baseball now.
That's it. You just have the perfect life of an elderly woman. It's really amazing.
I appreciate you brought up knitting, Rachel, because as I'm sitting here in front of the mic, I also have my knitting in my hands because it's nice to be able to do, you know, have something to do with my hands while also like paying attention to a conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's knitting is, everybody should knit. Everybody should learn to do some kind of handicraft. It is life-changing.
It is really nice. Also, there are really nice yarns to squish all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I used to work at a yarn store. It was constant temptation.
I tried knitting once. It did not go well. I am maybe perhaps the least crafty person who has ever existed on the planet. But I enjoy knitwear, so I would like to at one point be able to knit something that does not manage to injure me with the needles. And it's also something that I wouldn't be embarrassed to be seen wearing.
Mary, see, before I say, oh, go ahead.
Before I started knitting a few years ago, I would have said the same thing. I would have been like, I'm the least crafty person. I'm uncoordinated. I've got stupid garbage fingers. All the stuff I made initially was garbage, and it no longer exists. But if you keep at it, like, you can do it. Anybody can do it.
And Mary, what I was going to say was that I originally thought that you probably injured yourself in some way with needles and then apologized to the needles after, because I know that's what you would do.
Listen, you can take the person out of Canada, okay? But there's always going to be the apologizing.
So, back to baseball. Rachel, you mentioned to us that NHK recently aired a documentary on Shohei Ohtani. What were your thoughts on it, and is it worth seeking out for baseball fans?
I would say that it's definitely worth seeking out for baseball fans. Twitter users at Smilodon48 and at Shohei Save Us uploaded a version with English subs, which is the one I watched, and it's about 50 minutes long, and it's basically just covering Ohtani's first year in the major leagues. And they obviously managed to have more in-depth interviewing with him, since he's not fluent in English. And it was just a really fascinating peek into what goes on behind the scenes of this person who we all kind of projected these huge expectations on, and then projected these hopes of greatness once he turned out to be amazing. Because I think the things he has to say about his experience of the game are really interesting. Like, the interviewers were asking him about the fact that he spends almost all day every day, like, at the ballpark. Like, he goes to the ballpark and he goes home, and that's all he does. And they were like, do you just have, like, a great work ethic? And he said that it was more that he doesn't know what else there is other than baseball. Like, what more is there in life? And it was also another interesting aspect of it was talking about, like, his emotional reaction to the UCL injuries that sidelined him. And that's something that we didn't really get a strong perspective out on in the American media while it was happening. But the first time around when he was injured in the middle of the summer, apparently he became extremely depressed and didn't leave his apartment for a week. But then his reaction when he actually needed to have surgery in September was completely different. Like, he felt he had more of a community at that point. And that really seems to be the driving force, like, thematically behind the documentary, is that he kind of struggles with this isolation of being somebody who had these huge expectations, doing something that nobody has really done before in baseball for a long, long time. And also being somebody who doesn't really speak the language in North America. He's not adjusted to the culture, and he doesn't drive. So there's not really a lot. There's not really a lot of community for him to find himself integrated into, and not a lot of community for him to be able to process the things that are happening to him. And it was just a really fascinating peek behind the scenes of Ohtani. Like, we all know Ohtani is an amazing baseball player, and we're all thrilled to see him play. But I'm always interested in what is going on in the background with baseball players and the way they relate to the game emotionally and mentally. And so this was, like, a great opportunity to see that. And I would definitely recommend go on YouTube and search for it.
I think that's something that a lot of white baseball fans need to learn about how white Major League Baseball is, and how kind of othering or lonely it can be for non-white players, particularly non-English speaking players to come into the league and to have nobody that they can really talk to, and to come into cities that are predominantly English and not be able to find a community.
Yeah, and also it's just, like, a really good look into like sports psychology and like the psyche of a ball player, especially coming from one country to another. So this sounds like a really, really good documentary to look at.
Yeah, I think the three of us will certainly have to check it out, and I hope that a lot of our listeners do the same.
Please do. It's fantastic.
All right. Well, let's move on to This Week in Baseball History, where we're throwing it all the way back to January 16th, 1878. The newly formed Providence Grays hire Benjamin Douglas as manager, moving him from Hartford to Providence. However, he was shockingly fired for, quote, insubordination before the season began. It later became known that he was actually fired for attempting to schedule games with non-league teams, which was a big no-no at the time.
Classic Benjamin.
So moving ahead some odd 40 years or so, January 25th, 1942, FDR officially announces that baseball will continue to be played throughout the duration of World War II, asserting that doing so would be good for the nation.
Jumping ahead to the 50s, January 14th, 1954, Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe get married, which, wow, that was a lot of M's in that sentence. Mazel tov to the not-so-happy couple.
And finally, on January 16th, 2003, the owners unanimously voted to make home field advantage in the World Series conditional upon winning the All-Star Game, which, obviously, they rolled back a bit more than a decade later.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, seriously, one of the worst decisions concerning the actual playing of the game that owners have ever made.
I wouldn't say ever, but it was pretty bad. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times audio. You can find the Hardball Times at fangraphs.com/THT and on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at @JenMacRamos. You can find Sarah at @SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at @MaryMCraig. You can find Rachel at @RunHamlet. And you can find the podcast on Twitter at THT Audio. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. And you can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on iTunes. Please rate and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next week for another episode.